From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming.
I've always been somewhat defiant of, you absolutely, positively have to be in New York, especially since we have the sort of democratizing influence of the internet.
That's Stephen Thompson, an editor at NPR Music. He says plenty of art is made a world apart from the cultural hubs of New York and L.A. This hour, do culture makers from the coasts call too many shots? And can regional voices make a difference today? It's something we on TT Book think about a lot, since we're based in Wisconsin. And Marilyn Robinson remembers what it was like becoming known as a writer from the West.
On learning that I'm from Idaho, people have not infrequently asked, then how were you able to write a book?
Ever ride a bus or a train and notice everybody's reading the same three or four books? It's a phenomenon that drives Charles McNair crazy. He's the book's editor at Paste Magazine and an avowed champion of Southern literary voices. McNair told Ann Strangchamps that a handful of opinions from critics out of New York and L.A. carry too much weight and keep unknown voices from rising to the top.
Well, let me give you an example of two writers that I believe would be celebrated internationally if they didn't live where they happen to live. Both of these live in Arkansas, which is not renowned as a center of cultural taste-making, unless you like Walmart. I would say that these two writers, one is named Donald Harrington, and the other is named Charles Portis. Both have written a number of books. I'd say of the two, the better known is Charles Portis. He wrote True Grit, and he wrote a great book called Norwood. These are central figures in American writing today, in my opinion. There's another writer, Kevin Brockmeyer, who is younger. He's more celebrated. He also is living, now in Arkansas and from Arkansas. So we have these three names who I believe, had they been West Coast names anywhere around Hollywood or on the East Coast, anywhere around that great pulsar of communication, the New York scene, would be widely celebrated and, you know, as famous as Norman Mailer or, let's say, from the West Coast, Joan Didion.
Now, why is that, do you think? Because I would imagine that if we were to call Lev Grossman, say, the book editor at Time magazine, or John Thurber at the LA Times, or Michiko Kakutani at the New York Times, they would say not only do they not care where a writer lives, often they don't even know.
I'd say that's true, certainly for Lev. He's a friend of mine. I've known him for a few years. He's also a darn good writer himself. So naturally, he's going to know what good writing is. I think that in this case, Marshall McLuhan was right. The medium is the message. It's where they write. It's the megaphones they have that matter more than anything else. If you are in New York and you're writing for Time magazine or the New York Times or New Yorker, you have, for better or worse, an opinion that seems to matter more than the opinion from Atlanta, Georgia, or from Moscow, Idaho. There are 100 million people who live in the South. Why isn't it so that some cultural voice here matters everywhere else, the way the New York Times matters, or the way the LA Times matters out there? I have a number of theories about this, and probably none of them account for it wholly, but...
Well, what are some of your theories?
For one thing, the South hasn't helped itself much by being as ornery as it has proven to be through the past several centuries. You start out with a losing nation. The South lost the Civil War. And hence, you know, you retire to the loser's corner and you sit and you brood for 100 years. And out of that, there did leap some voices and some folks got notice over years. But in the main, it was, as H.L. Mencken pronounced it, the Sahara of the Beaux-Arts. Now, that is an attitude that took hold. And rightly or wrongly, there's a stereotype about that. I remember a Lenny Bruce line from the Lenny Bruce years, the 1960s. He was making a to-do about how the Southern accent is the least respected accent in any speaking idiom anywhere. And he made the point by saying, if Albert Einstein had talked like this, there wouldn't be no bomb. That is a quote from Lenny Bruce. Now, there is great truth in that.
On the other hand, there are entire college classes taught on the great Southern writers. We produce this show out of the Midwest. I'm pretty sure there aren't any college classes on great Midwestern writers.
Well, there should be. And I would say that I'm not only arguing this case for the Southern, the 100 million people in the South, although I'm from Alabama and a deep Southerner, but also for these other propinquities that ought to have a cultural voice that people listen to, that people hearken to.
It's interesting that one theory you didn't mention would have to do with money. I mean, a huge pile of the nation's money is centered in New York and another huge pile in Los Angeles. Those are simply the places where if you want to start a national newspaper or a national arts magazine, that's where the money is and that's where you start it. Surely that's part of the picture.
I don't think that that's wrong in any way. I don't think, though, that if one is an artist, that one would accept that that has to be the way people get attention. I'm the books editor at a little magazine that popped up out of nowhere in Decatur, Georgia. It's called Paste Magazine. And when we were a paper publication, we were a finalist for 4 years in a row for, in general excellence, for the National Magazine Award. It's like the Oscar of the magazine world. We were nosed out 1 year by National Geographic, 1 year by New York Magazine. So a very fine magazine. We have evolved due to necessity and probably smartness to online only now, and Paste is making money. We position ourselves as being signs of life in culture. And we hope that this publication somehow or another would become an influencer, a place where people came as a destination to hear not what New York thought, not what LA thought, but culture with a Southern accent. What did people think who lived down here, this 100 million folks? You know, we have a lot more in common with this voice here than we do with the voice in New York and the voice in California. And you would say the same for the people in the Midwest. They should have something there. The tragedy is, you talk about the money. I look around this landscape here. There is not one single newspaper that speaks with a regional voice anymore.
The internet, of course, is springing up, and lots of people can publish there and find a readership. Do you possibly see a kind of a new renaissance of regional writing, regional culture because of the internet?
Well, again, this is almost at odds with the idea of celebrity in a way. You can be a hometown hero easier now through the internet. The question is, how do you jump over the barricade of the hometown and into the larger picture? I think that's not easier than it used to be. I think that rather than being the great democratizer, what the internet has become and offered us is the great segmenter. It allows people who believe one thing to burrow ever deeper into that one single thing they believe at the expense of seeing and running and colliding into other ideas and other influences. So I'm not sure that the internet is the answer to this question of parochiality and this question of, you know, local versus national attention getting.
Well, I'm curious. In 2011, you wrote a review of a time travel novel called The Revisionists, and you said it was a really, really good novel, maybe great. But you pointed out that it had the bad luck to come out at about the same time as Stephen King's last book, which was also about time travel. You know, the result was King's book got reviewed, The Revisionist didn't. Did the fact that you pointed that out in print make a difference, do you think?
Well, it made a difference to me and to that writer. At least there was my little megaphone and my little voice saying into this great wide world a thing that ought to have been said about that book. I think that Tom Mullen, that writer who wrote The Revisionist, is going to be a very big writer if and when that stardust ever falls on him. It depends on others. It's terrible to think that it depends on others, that it can't happen just by dint of your own talent and your own skill. But it has always been that way. And we go on about Hollywood, but nothing is more true than that good luck accounts for very much out there. And it's likely true in New York. Good luck accounts for a lot of things, not just the skill. And I believe that I would probably be right in saying that there are writers in Brooklyn and in Queens and in downtown Manhattan who are having the same lament that we are discussing here, that somehow or another the powers that be swing those arc lamps across the heavens in other directions, not on them, and what's to be done. I'd love to remedy that.
Charles McNair is a Pulitzer Prize-nominated author and the books editor at Paste Magazine. He lives in Atlanta, Georgia, and Strange Champ spoke with him.
I used to dream that I would leave one day in this local bar drinking beer all day. I got a good job, so I might as well stay at the Walmart right off the highway. And this ain't New York, and this ain't L.A. This is my small town in the USA. We're not New York, and we're not L.A. This is my small town in the USA.
What do you think? Do New York and L.A. drive too much of American culture? We'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email us at ttbook.org or weigh in on our Facebook page. Novelist Leslie Kagan was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. She then followed the time-honored path of the young and artistic before her and spent a chunk of her life living in New York and later a decade in Los Angeles, where she had a successful career as an actress and voiceover artist. She'd done it. She'd left Wisconsin in the dust.
I was fed up with Wisconsin, sick of the weather, the provincialism of it all. So when I was 26 years old, I threw what little I owned in my car and hightailed it down Route 66. Let them eat cheese, I thought. Do the polka. Life in the City of Angels, bright lights, big city, that's for me. And for many years it was. I worked steadily as an actress in Hollywood. I fell in love with a man from Milwaukee in Malibu, of all places. We were married and had kids. I should have been happier than I was. I was living the dream. Why then couldn't I shake the feeling that I was missing something? What could I possibly be yearning for in the land of milk and honey? Potato rolls. My dreams were a buffet. Mamma Mia's pizza and butter-drenched garlic bread. Cream-filled coffee cakes from Moyer's Bakery. The ones with the streusel on top. Bratwurst. But it was more than food that I was craving. Mountains, schmountains. I missed the predictable flatness of Wisconsin. The fierce thunderstorms. The flaming reds and oranges of October. And the people. I miss them too. The kind of folks who lived in the same neighborhoods they grew up in and took pride in lending a helping hand. It didn't happen overnight. It took a while for me to figure out that I wanted to run back home, not just for me, but for my kids. I became obsessed with them growing up the way I'd grown up. I wanted to gift them the same kind of childhood I held dear. Eating schnitzel, drinking out of bubblers, 4th of July parades, Bradford Beach, first snows. I casually dropped the idea of moving back to Milwaukee at a cocktail party a friend was throwing. She looked at me aghast and then laughed. You must be joking. Do they even have fruit there? My husband, thank goodness, could at least envision the idea. While not missing home the way I was, he understood my desperate need to give the kids what we'd had growing up, to ground them in the solidness of it all. So back we came. And you know, you actually can go home again. Everything was right where I left it. Supper that night was Mamma Mia's pizza and garlic bread beneath a tree in our new backyard that was on fire with fall. We fell asleep to a thunderstorm of epic proportions. Early the next morning, I picked up a Moyer's cream-filled coffee cake. And as I drove home down the streets I had driven down so many times before, for the first time in a long time, I realized that gnawing feeling in my stomach and my soul had disappeared. I felt full.
Leslie Kagan makes her living these days as a novelist. Her latest is called Good Graces. She lives and eats in Milwaukee. I'm Jim Fleming. Coming up, an alumnus from The Onion remembers the paper's Wisconsin roots and why regionalism still matters in art today. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Stephen Thompson considers himself a Wisconsin boy. It's the place he calls home, even though he makes his living these days as a reviewer and editor at NPR Music. But before NPR, Thompson did something audacious. He joined his friends on the now-celebrated satirical newspaper The Onion. The Onion was born in Madison, just like To the Best of Our Knowledge. Thompson did his part by launching the non-satirical part of the paper, the art section known as the AV Club. He told Steve Paulson that at the time, in the pre-internet era, it seemed unlikely that The Onion would ever be more than a regional paper.
Well, I think that one advantage that The Onion had, you know, especially early on, was that it didn't come from a traditional humor center. And so it didn't have this filter of like a bunch of, and you know, no knock on people who went to Harvard to become comedy writers, but it didn't sort of come from this place of, you know, formal training and, you know, a certain amount of privilege. It came from a lot of sort of working class folks who, you know, they went to the University of Wisconsin, you know, generally, you know, which is a public university, and generally on in-state tuition. And you know, some of those people had even dropped out, you know, by the time they were really, you know, writing for The Onion. But I think it really benefited from that outsider's perspective.
And did that affect the content, do you think, or your particular slant on what made something funny?
Well, you know, absolutely. I think that there was a lot of day-to-day experience in a lot of the writing. I think a lot of The Onion's sort of template comes from drab, unfulfilling everyday existence a little bit. And there's an editor at the Onion who's still there named John Crewson, who's a very good friend of mine. And he always used to give new writers and new employees what he called the Crewson test. And it was sort of this series of, you know, what's the worst thing you've ever done for minimum wage? And, you know, specifics about like, what is the difference between a Hobart and a Bun-O-Matic? And, you know, one is like the industrial grade coffee maker and one is the industrial grade meat slicer. And, you know, you didn't have to get all the questions right. But the idea was he really liked to have, and The Onion really liked to have, people who knew what it was like to work a terrible, terrible job. You know, and I think that informed a lot of The Onion's humor, is that there's a certain amount of populism to it that comes from not having had all of this highfalutin training.
And what's interesting is it went on to become a huge success while it was still based in Wisconsin. I mean, it gained a national following. So obviously this sensibility was not just appealing to people in the Midwest.
Right. Man, the internet came along at just the right time for us, you know, because we had certainly built up a certain amount of feelings of being isolated from the sort of somewhat imaginary power brokers in, you know, in New York and Los Angeles. You know, we sort of felt like, oh, they're there and we're here. And there was a certain amount of attraction to those places. And, you know, a number of Onion writers in the early days kind of en masse moved to LA to become TV writers. And a bunch of them are still very, very successful at it today. You know, so there was somewhat of a sense of we're this somewhat isolated pocket of people, and if we wanted to reach a national audience, we would have to leave and go there. And but when the internet came along, all of a sudden, you know, we were on the internet, and like I think within 6 weeks, there was an article about us in the New Yorker, and we were kind of, you know, we were kind of like, oh, you know, all of a sudden there's this great equalizing presence that allows us to compete on a level playing field.
It is worth pointing out that The Onion did move its offices to New York back in 2001. Now, you've just been saying that, you know, you could do a lot of your work on the internet. Why did you end up moving to New York?
Well, the comedy staff moved to New York in part because they felt, and you know, they sort of felt isolated, and you know, they wanted to sort of be among other comedy people. Part of it is you know, the editor-in-chief at that time, Rob Siegel, he was from Long Island, and so New York was home to him. You know, so there was a certain pull of New York for him, and then for a lot of the comedy writers who were under him, you know, there was sort of a sense they had been in Madison for a long, long time, and they wanted to, you know, rub elbows with people who, you know, they had sort of professional connections with. There was, you know, sort of a sense like, this is our hometown. We've been here for a long time. You know, maybe we can branch out and find bigger and better things. That was sort of, you know, their mindset. And I didn't want to pay twice what I paid for my mortgage for a studio apartment. So, you know, at the time I was about to become a dad, and I didn't necessarily have that gnawing desire to become a New Yorker.
Mm-hmm. Now, there is a trope in American culture that if you want to make it big in the literary scene or on Broadway, you have to go to New York. If you want to make movies, you have to go to L.A. Every place else is kind of like the waiting room, waiting for something bigger and better to happen. How much truth is there in that cliche?
I mean, I have always sort of raged against that cliche, you know, because I've seen, you know, really intriguing art spring out of other places. And I always think that any sort of great collaborative art simply comes from chemistry between or among, you know, a few people. And that can happen. I saw that happen in Madison, Wisconsin. And so I've always been somewhat defiant of, you know, oh, you absolutely positively have to be in New York, especially since we have the sort of democratizing influence of the internet. At the same time, you know, I've sometimes been guilty of kind of reflexively ignoring what's, you know, what goes on there. And you don't want to do that either. You want to stay somewhat plugged into what people are saying there. But, you know, through the power of, you know, social media and traveling, I feel like you can have it both ways. But at the same time, I've never tried to make it as a screenwriter. And, you know, I've been lucky enough to carve out most of my career in either Madison, Wisconsin or Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm. You stayed in Madison for a while, even after a lot of the Onion staff went off to New York City.
Correct. And a lot of my staff on the AV Club had gone to Chicago. And Chicago had sort of become, you know, the hub of where a lot of the sort of entertainment writing was coming from. I happened to stay based in Madison because I had a family and I had a house, and I love Madison. I mean, Madison is very sort of etched into each individual strand of my DNA. And it was very hard, it took NPR really to get me to leave Madison.
Okay, so you follow music really closely. I mean, you are an editor and a reviewer for NPR. How much do you think it matters for up-and-coming musicians where they're based? I mean, if they are in, I don't know, in the Midwest or the South or the Southwest, is that a strike against them?
I don't think it is. And, you know, I think as much as anything, sometimes being based in a place like Brooklyn, you know, every once in a while, yeah, artists there can sort of catch lightning in a bottle and have a lot of people be interested in them. But, you know, at the same time, I feel like there's also a lot to be gained from sort of building up a little bit more slowly in the place that you call home and sort of developing, you know, your live chops and your regional reputation. And you know, you look at a band when you talk about Wisconsin, everybody sort of talks about Bon Iver. And the fact that Bon Iver has stayed based in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and really made that a big part of its specialness and its identity. The fact that it sort of captures, you know, what it's like to be in the, you know, in the upper Midwest and what it's like to be in the winter in Wisconsin. And I think that's become a big part of kind of the allure and the cachet of that particular music.
And it's worth pointing out that when Justin Vernon, the frontman for Bon Iver, just got his Grammy, he kind of made a point of that and, you know, sort of gave that shout out to Eau Claire, Wisconsin, and to all those people who aren't sort of in that more highly commercialized circuit.
Yeah, that guy wears Wisconsin like a badge of honor. When you see him on talk shows, you know, he'll perform on David Letterman and you'll see like a little Bucky Badger head poking out of his solar plexus. And for somebody like me who has, you know, fairly deep Wisconsin roots, there's real joy in that. But, you know, if you're from the American Southwest, there are going to be elements to the culture there that are going to creep into your music in interesting ways. And I think if you have every ambitious musician based in one city, you're kind of losing a lot of these kind of regional dialects and what ultimately adds to musical uniqueness that is going to be very important to an artist's, you know, sort of success and importance. And so I think a little bit too much emphasis is paid to, oh, you have to be in Brooklyn, because I think that can sort of bleach out some of what might make you interesting.
You now have lived in the Washington, D.C. area for some years now. You're from Wisconsin, grew up here, went to college here. Do you think of yourself essentially as a Wisconsinite?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I've really grown to love living in Washington, D.C., and I've found that generally, the more I travel, the more you really get a sense that people are, you know, I like to think fundamentally nice wherever you go, and you can always find great people anywhere. Washington, D.C. is full of terrific people, you know, but at the same time, I think leaving Wisconsin has made me probably more of a diehard Wisconsinite. I never miss a Packer game. You know, I never miss a Badger game. You know, more and more there's kind of this, you know, you find other people who are from Wisconsin or have a connection to Wisconsin, and you kind of speak this little special language with people. And I definitely probably more think of myself as a Wisconsinite now than I did when I lived in Wisconsin.
I guess that's an old story. Often you have to go away to really appreciate where you came from.
Well, judging by how hard I cried when I left, you know, I think I appreciated living there when I was there.
Thank you, Stephen. This has been fun.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
Stephen Thompson is an editor and reviewer at NPR Music and the founder of the Onion's AV Club section. He spoke with Steve Paulson.
Did you miss the golden age of the bent-over grandma? The plywood grandmas have dwindled now, but they're still to be found around these parts, their paint flaking, their plywood delaminating in the sun and rain, grandma's exposed polka-dot bloomers leached of color. When they first appeared on the scene, the plywood grandmas were culturally divisive. Some social critics declared them trashy and demeaning. Others found them a real knee-slapper. Whatever the take, they proliferated, and soon some joker designed a companion piece, a rear view of a grandpa in overalls, a red handkerchief out his back pocket, and his hand planted firmly on grandma's ample rear. In New Auburn, as in any place, lawn art is a form of public display as simultaneously trite and revealing as bumper stickers and nose rings. Between the porch and the road, iconography sprouts. The bathtub Madonna, the milk cow windmill, giant mushrooms carved from stumps, yellow Norwegian crossing traffic signs. These images speak to who we are. Let me be the first to say, grandma bending over is no nude descending a staircase. I could do without whirling plastic sunflowers, but more than that, I want to be in a place I understand. Fake deer and Packer ornaments, goofy mailboxes, they tell me I am in a place where, for better or worse, I know the code.
Ed, to the best of our knowledge, we're pretty proud of being from Wisconsin. Maybe as proud as Wisconsin writer Michael Perry, who's made it his vocation to write with humor about his life in a little Wisconsin town called New Auburn. His memoirs, Population 485 and Truck, A Love Story, hit the bestseller lists, and he keeps up a magazine career writing for the likes of Esquire, the New York Times Magazine, and Salon.com. It's an enviable career by almost any standard. Perry came into the studio to talk about what it takes to make it as a writer from Wisconsin.
I've always had an ambivalence about the term writer with a capital W or about the term artist. I've never really made any bones about the fact that I'm first and foremost self-employed, and I associate regularly with artists of certainly much purer talent and intent. And so I didn't really ever have a plan, but it is interesting. I was living in Eau Claire, Wisconsin, when I really started to write. I went to the library and checked out a book on how to be a writer. It was that basic. And I spent time writing brochures and ads and frozen pizza ads and radio copy and did things for used car dealers. But I was also going to poetry readings and studying writing and hanging out in bars with writers, even though I didn't drink or smoke. And I wound up eventually, I was getting a few pieces published here and there, and I was just surviving, and I moved back to my hometown of New Auburn, Wisconsin. And the feedback I got from a lot of people was not negative, but cautionary. They said, well, why are you moving there? There's nothing there. If you want to be a writer, you need to go to the East Coast or the West Coast. And of course, for me, it turned out that everything was there, because the first book that I wrote that got any sort of pleasant attention was Population 485, which was about growing up and going back to my hometown of New Auburn.
Population 485 was really a hit, and people know Wisconsin for the Packers. These days, everybody knows Bon Iver as well, and have heard about that hit. Album came out of a little shack north of Eau Claire. But Population 485 in some ways sort of started things off. Is it that people don't know what to think of flyover country?
Yeah, I think it's partly they don't know what to think. I remember one thing I ran into early on. I had a section in Population 45 about dirt track stock car racing, because I love going to the dirt track stock car races a couple of times a year. And I just grew up with that, and some of my buddies race. And someone in New York read that and said, well, I don't think that should be in there. You know, I don't think stock car racing is really a Wisconsin or Midwestern thing, is it? That's a Southern thing. Well, of course not. I mean, just very recently, the Daytona 500 was won by Matt Kenseth, the guy out of Wisconsin. And the legendary Dave Marcus was a great NASCAR racer out of Wausau. And Alan Kulwicki and Paul Menard out of Eau Claire. And even Danica Patrick did her early racing in Beloit, although she was raised in Illinois. And my personal favorite, partly because his hometown is Wisconsin Rapids, where I was born, but the legendary NASCAR racer Dick Trickle is a Wisconsin guy. And so I think sometimes people are surprised about those parts of Wisconsin. On the other hand, you turn right around and you embrace things. Like, I've had people tell me they think that the term cheesehead is demeaning or offensive, and I just go, you know what? If that's the worst thing someone could call you, man, you're coasting. And furthermore, I always say that, you know, I do this as a joke, but I say, you know, we try to remake our image, and we are Wisconsin, and we are about many more things than cheeseheads. We're about art, and we're about culture, and all these things. And then, of course, what happens every once in a while, the Packers go to the Super Bowl, and the whole world tunes in, and half the people there are wearing blaze orange snowsuits and cheeseheads, and we got to start all over again. So I say, just go with it.
What people don't understand is those are nice and warm.
Absolutely, and they can save your life in a plane crash, too. So.
That's right. What did your agent think? I guess the first question is, was it hard to get an agent when you live in New Auburn, Wisconsin?
Yeah, I can tell you exactly how I got an agent. I just wrote for 10 years, self-published 4 books, wrote for every magazine and person that came along, clawed my way into places like the New York Times Magazine and GQ and Esquire, all without an agent. And then one day, somebody in New York read one of my essays, found out a little bit about me, and went to this agent and said, hey, there's this unusual long-haired writer living in northern Wisconsin. You should read more of his stuff. And sadly, the long hair is gone, but the agent is still here. And so I got a phone call in New Auburn, Wisconsin, out of the blue. That's how it happened. I never tracked her down. She tracked me down. And she did say, what are you doing up there in Wisconsin? She was calling from New York. You know, geography is what it is to them. But she said, what are you doing up there in Wisconsin? And do you have any more of it? And so I sent her a whole pile of stuff, and here we are.
Have you trained her to speak more lovingly of northern Wisconsin over the years?
I think she says nice things about Wisconsin, but you've hit on something. I did have a publicist one time, and they always want to do things to make you feel at home. And so I did a big book event out in L.A. at Book Expo, and they said, we're going to do what we can to make you feel at home. And when I got there, they had set out a big tray in the middle of this huge function in Los Angeles, a tray filled with Budweiser and cheese curds. And, of course, the irony is that I don't drink. And then the other thing was I did have to, my publicist, I said, you know, that was very sweet, but let me educate you about it. The cheese curd has to squeak or it's not legit. And I thought that was something I just said in passing and in good humor. And a few months later, he was interviewed by some trade magazine, and they were asking him about things he'd learned as a publicist. And lo and behold, he said, well, I have learned from author Michael Perry that the sign of a quality cheese curd is the squeak. And so I thought, you know, I'm doing what I can for us. I'm spreading the gospel.
You know, what's interesting to me in part about that is that, you know, most of the writers in this country, we have the impression anyway that most of the writers in the country live in New York and maybe in Brooklyn for that matter, and that what's really important is connections. But it makes me wonder when you tell a story like that whether when you live in the Midwest you can make any of those connections.
Well, here's my answer, and it's a two-parter. The first part is that everything I'm about to say doesn't reflect the fact that everything is changing hourly now. I mean, publishing is in a state of, it's not so much in a state of free fall as it is chaos, and it's a creative chaos, and it is what it is. But my experience, and now I'm going to lay some numbers on you that I've made up, so let me just tell you that right up front. But my experience is from spending time in New York, from spending time in the publishing world, books and magazines, is that the truth is somewhere around 70 to 80% of those folks went to one of five East Coast schools. They do all know each other. They go to the same publishing parties. People know each other. But the good news for the rest of us is there is this window of, I don't know, let's say 30 to 20% for just knuckleheaded persistence and some talent. And you do have a shot if you just keep plugging away.
It's not fair to ask you because the times have changed since 1995. Do you have advice for young writers who are in the same situation you are? They don't want to go to New York, or they can't afford to go to New York. They don't want to go to L.A. And anyway, they're really happy where they are, but they'd like to establish a career as a writer. What do you tell them?
Well, there's never been a better time. You can make your voice heard in ways that never, never were possible back when I started. But the one thing has not changed. You just have to sit down and write. I get a lot of, you know, I get six or eight manuscripts a week folks send to me, and they ask me very politely to read them and give, and I just can't get it all done. But what you can do is just sit down and write. And then I set up my own readings. I self-published my first book, and this was before print on demand, so I had to get 1,000 of them printed in order to hit a price break. And then I had great incentive to sell them because I had 1,000 books in my garage. And I did readings at craft fairs, and I did readings just in malls. I did whatever it took. And that's all true. You still need to do that, and you still need to create the work. You have ways to get it out there now that you never did before. And the idea of having to go to L.A. and New York is rapidly becoming outmoded.
The flip side, of course, is that, as you said, most of the writers are still in New York and L.A., or at least on the East Coast and the West Coast. Do you think there's any danger in that? Are there artistic costs to having all those people in one place seeing each other? And I guess what I'm saying is maybe not so much the rest of us.
Well, sure, because there develops a certain tunnel vision. Let me be clear. The people in New York, specifically in my case, I've dealt with a few people out of L.A., but mostly the people, they've changed my life. I'm ever grateful to the editors and the agents that I've worked with out there. They've allowed me to live a life in my, you know, my home state that I never could have dreamed of. So everything I say is said with love. But I do get a kick sometimes out of, they look at us sometimes I don't know what to say. It's not condescension, but it's a sort of benevolent understanding that we are provincial and we do have a narrow little view of things. And then they'll turn right around and do something like trying to, when I'm living in New Auburn, they would always book my flights for book tour out of Milwaukee. And I would always have to call and explain that Milwaukee is 5 hours from New Auburn and that Minneapolis-St. Paul is an hour and a half away with airplanes that go all over the world. And twice I had publicists say, oh, but New Auburn is in Wisconsin. And I'd say, yes. And we are allowed to cross the Minnesota border freely. And so that kind of stuff happens where they're not being, you know, there's nothing negative in that, but they're as oblivious to our way of life as we are to some of theirs. And so, of course, you can get tunnel vision no matter where you are. But I'm always careful about that, too, because you don't want to get disingenuous. I mean, I criticize myself sometimes for veering too easily toward that whole kick your toe in the dirt and say, oh, I don't know nothing about nothing. Well, of course, you know, I have read a couple of books, and I do like to go to the feed mill, but I also like to read a little Montaigne now and then. And so we all have our blind spots, I guess, is what I'm saying.
Michael Perry is a humorist and memoirist from New Auburn, Wisconsin. Perry's best-selling books include Population 485 and Truck, A Love Story. Coming up, Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Marilyn Robinson on what it means to be a writer from the West. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. You can take a writer out of the West, but you can't take the West out of the writer. That, in a nutshell, is how Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Marilyn Robinson feels. She grew up in Idaho, lived on the East Coast for a time, and now teaches at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. She talked with Steve Paulson about her new collection of essays called When I Was a Child, I Read Books, and read him a passage from the title essay.
I went to college in New England, and I've lived in Massachusetts for 20 years, and I find that the hardest work in the world, it may in fact be impossible, is to persuade Easterners that growing up in the West is not intellectually crippling. On learning that I'm from Idaho, people have not infrequently asked, then how were you able to write a book? Once or twice when I felt cynical or lazy, I've replied, I went to Brown, thinking that might appease them. Only to be asked, how did you manage to get into Brown? One woman, on learning of my origins, said, but there has to be talent in the family somewhere.
That is wonderful. Why do you think there has been this assumption that Idaho is an intellectual backwater?
Well, I have no idea, really. I think that, and this is just a theory of mine, I think that many people who have come to this country never left one coast or the other. And they brought with them the assumption that might be appropriate in other cultures, that people who lived in the countryside tended to be, you know, non-literate or, you know, or at least outside the stream of things in ways that there was nothing to compensate them for. But it's not realistic for the settlement of this country or for the life of it. We've had very efficient distribution of information for a long time, and we've had, you know, books that were relatively cheap and accessible for a long time. And actually, if you look at literacy rates and levels of reading and so on, they're higher in places like Iowa than they are in the country at large. And the readership of books is higher in the Western states than it is in the East. And I mean the interior West, you know.
Mm-hmm.
These assumptions are ones, I think, that are maybe carried over from the history of other cultures and the demographics of other cultures and are not appropriate here.
Now, you write that you were a bookish child and you were especially drawn to writers from previous centuries. As you put it, your own literary style is more indebted to Cicero than even to Hemingway. Do you think this has something to do with growing up in the far West?
I think it did have a great deal to do with it. I was growing up, you know, in the part of the country that was not at that time particularly influenced by progressive impulses from either coast. And so I had a very old-fashioned education. By old-fashioned, I mean progressive in an older style and perhaps a more effective one, because there was a lot of the romance of learning, the importance of knowing things for the sake of knowing them. Very, very non-utilitarian idea of learning that I think I benefited from very much and that I think was a sort of dying ember of 19th century idealism.
It almost sounds like you were perhaps not as subjected to intellectual fashions as perhaps people on the coasts might have been.
I think yes, or in any case, strong old intellectual fashions, you know, that I think were more optimistic about what the joys of education were, much less likely to treat us as people that were outside the history of world civilization, oddly enough. I mean, I was taught, living in Idaho, that there was a great deal of value about knowing about the Roman Republic, for example. Hmm. The idea being that we really were still rooted deeply in civilization from, you know, from early periods. And the more you get into other fads that swept later on, the less you find this to be assumed. I think it was incredibly valuable because history is what human beings can know about themselves, you know, and it is interesting to know about the Roman Republic.
Mm-hmm. Now, this essay that we've been talking about, When I Was a Child, is partly a meditation on your own experience of growing up in Idaho and also a reflection on the cultural values of the West. And you have kind of a fascinating discussion of various words that I guess have different associations for Westerners. For instance, you say lonesome. Mm-hmm. Has a very positive connotation, which may not be the case for people on the East Coast.
Yes, I think that's true. I mean, I felt as if in a certain way I was being groomed in my family and also in my education to have a great capacity for loneliness and a pleasure in it, you know? I mean, it was as if I remember one of my teachers saying, you must make yourself into someone with whom you will want to spend time because you will spend the rest of your life with yourself, you know? I just took that to be human life. I felt that was a kind of universal description of what was to be desired. And I have always, therefore, entered into loneliness with a great deal of optimism and pleasure.
Whereas nowadays, when people talk about loneliness or being lonesome, it, you know, it's the kind of thing that people go to therapy for to try to get rid of.
Exactly.
There are other words too that you say had a similarly positive connotation: melancholy, regret.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Again, that I think is quite 19th century, you know, but also the understanding that there is an aesthetic quality to the experience that you have evaluating your life, even if what you are given to evaluate is sad, is loss. It's, you know, when you look at poetry from every culture, this is always a big subject and a lot of beautiful thought surrounds it, you know. I think that we have become very much afraid of experiences that have anything of the quality of pain because we think they're symptoms, perhaps, you know, for which there must be a cure, when in fact the human situation simply involves these things. And if we are to appreciate the wholeness of human circumstance, we have to appreciate them too.
So what was it about coming from the West that gave more meaning to those kinds of sentiments, like loneliness?
Well, seeing the example of people around me. You know, my great-grandparents homesteaded, and they lived in a house that was extremely isolated, and that was the norm. That was the thing to be desired. And when some sort of cousin actually built a house close enough so that at night they could see a light, they were disturbed. That was a major intrusion. And the, you know, it's a privilege, a strange, maybe diminishing privilege, to be in a place where all the lights go out and there are no sounds but the sounds of wind and animals and so on, you know. It has an aesthetic authority that is all its own, that one would not need to explain to anyone who had felt it, I think.
Now, if there's one value I think that we associate with the West, it's individualism. You know, we've seen it in all the Western movies that we've seen. Do you also embrace that value?
Well, I think it depends on what you mean by the word. I don't think most Western movies were probably made by Westerners. That's a theory of mine, that the sort of dime novel imposition of myths and so on this beautiful landscape, you know, has been very
influential. But if you think of individualism as being responsible for the integrity of your own behavior, and I think that that was the prevailing model of when the word individualism was spoken, then certainly I think that absolutely invaluable. It has been transformed to have something closer to a sort of European meaning, which is to proceed on the basis of one's own sense of self-interest without, you know, without a great deal of concern for other people. And that's not at all what I mean by the word. I think that I notice that I tend to be critical of prevailing ideas in many cases and so on. And I think that that's maybe a reflection of the fact that the other kind of individualism was encouraged in me, which was to test things against my own sense of true or false, right or wrong, whatever, and then try to articulate and understand the meaning of that response.
We've talked about how you grew up in Idaho. Of course, you've actually lived in the Midwest now for a number of years, teaching at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Do you still consider yourself a Westerner at heart?
I think there are ways in which I actually am a Westerner at heart. You know, my older son, who grew up in Massachusetts, went to Reed College. And I asked him how he liked it, and he said, "It's the first place I've ever been where my manners were appropriate." I think that within little households, you know, these ethnicities and regionalisms and so on sort of abide, persist, you know, among people that aren't even aware that they're preserving them.
Marilyn Robinson is the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the novels Gilead and Housekeeping. She teaches writing at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop. Steve Paulson spoke with her. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming, here in Madison, Wisconsin, where I can enjoy the Sheboygan bratwurst and six-year-old cheddar I could never find when I lived on the East Coast. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge at our website, ttbook.org, where you'll also find a wealth of past interviews with great thinkers, creators, and instigators. If you want to keep an eye on what's on our minds, follow us on Facebook. To buy a copy of the program, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for Kicking Off the Coasts. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Veronica Rickert, with help from Doug Gordon, Anne Strainchamps, Sarah Nix, and Charles Monroe Kane. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.